Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining us for this, which is our coverage of the fifth episode of season three of the X-Files, The List. And joining me today to discuss The List is Mike Schindler. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, not bad. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay, yeah.
You ready to get into a Chris Carter written and directed standalone episode?
Oh, always. Those always work out so well.
Yeah, well, let's see what we think about this one. So, as I said, this is the fifth episode of the third season. It originally aired on October 20th, 1995. Written and directed, as I said, by series director, series creator Chris Carter. And in this episode, the enemies of an executed prison inmate begin to die as stories circulate that a list comprising five possible victims exists. All right, Mike, so starting off, as we usually do, with some marks out of 10. I mean, what would you give this one out of 10?
I would say probably somewhere around a 5. Does that sound reasonable? I don't know.
It does sound reasonable, but just like, you know, kind of outline your thinking for me on that if you can.
I guess it does that thing that, you know, X-Files does. I mean, I think that this is really sort of like, you know, what you would see happen back in the day with a lot of television shows where they had, you know, like 25 episodes a season or whatever it is, where it's like, there are times where it's like, okay, we just need to like fill some gaps and, you know, we're going to go back to the old tried and true formula and, you know, churn something out and, you know, whatever. It seems like it's sort of like an interesting concept, but doesn't really have a lot of meat there. And while I kind of like the idea behind it, I think in the end, what it doesn't really have a lot to say. And that I think it's a problem with a lot of, you know, X-Files episodes, to be honest. And you know, it's just, I don't know. X-Files, it's one of those shows where it's like, you know, it's kind of like the original Star Trek, where you'll have like episodes which are like the best in the history of television, and then the next week you're just like, it's just like they're treading water. And I feel like this one is kind of one of those where they're sort of treading water.
Yeah, as regards like my rating, I think there's kind of two aspects to this, which is like, as a piece of like visual storytelling, I think this is quite impressive, to be honest. When it comes, so it'd probably get a high score in that regard. When it comes to like plotting and so forth, I don't know. I'm not quite as convinced on that front. So I'm going to be slightly kinder than you. I'm going to give it a 6, I think. But this is by no means my favorite of this season, and there's a lot of good stuff in season 3. In terms of the background to this one, I mean, this is Carter's second self-directed episode of the series. He directed Dwayne Barry the previous year. He doesn't direct then for a little while, but he comes back in season 5 with the postmodern Prometheus, and then afterwards he sort of goes back and forth between like these really like experimental episodes and like some of the big mythology installments. So this one is kind of an outlier, really. He doesn't really do a straight-up case of the week again until season 8, I think, with Patience. So it's kind of interesting from that regard. I mean, what did you make of, like, you know, Carter the director here?
I think he's pretty good. I mean, there were some moments which were impressive to me. I think that, I mean, along with the subject matter and everything, you know, there does seem to be a heavy influence from Silence of the Lambs, which, you know, obviously we know that that's the case in terms of like Scully's character and everything. But here there's sort of like another aspect to that. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess thinking about it, you know, I mean, what you're saying, I when I think of like the Chris Carter directed episodes, I do think of sort of the experimental ones, you know, and the fact that he is doing just sort of like a straight up episode here, I guess, sets an interesting baseline for those in the future. But yeah, he's a pretty good director on the whole, I'd say.
Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, this one is not like experimental, but what it is, I suppose, is like a big logistical endeavor, because apparently this the prison set they created for this episode, you know, the art department didn't get much kind of notice on this. They had to put it together quite quickly. And I thought that set was pretty damn good, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what it meant was like this turned out to be quite a costly episode, I think, to make. But they managed to use the set again in some other episodes, I believe. Like, there's an episode to Leifa Kumi where the set is reused, and they also rented it out to some other series. Mm. So I think they got some kind of mileage out of it. Some other logistical kind of hurdles. The use of maggots apparently caused a few problems. And there's also that, like, there's a car crash right at the end of the episode, isn't there?
Yeah, that car crash was incredibly impressive for, you know, like an episode of network television. It's like, you could definitely sort of like feel the impact of that. I'm like, they really just crashed that car, didn't they? and then the other thing that I thought of, like when you're looking at that shot, like, because I imagine there was a stuntman inside. I don't know. But, you know, if they did that, I mean, the way that the camera moves in that particular scene where it's sort of like looks like it's going into the hood of the car or whatever, and then they do that cut. I mean, yeah, that seems like a really complex scene to shoot for, you know, an hour of TV.
Yeah, it definitely felt very like visceral, didn't it? And in terms of like the fan response to this episode, I mean, I don't know how much credence you pay to like IMDb, but I mean, what would you guess this episode would get over there out of 10 on IMDb?
Well, I actually looked and saw, and I was surprised at how high it was, to be honest.
Yeah, well, they do tend to skew quite high, don't they, over there?
Yeah.
They give it a 7.3 out of 10, and that was from 2,359 people had rated it by the time I checked. Mm-hmm. And they actually, I mean, like you say, a little bit higher than you expected, but out of the whole season, this ranks, based on their ratings, as like 22nd out of 24.
That is surprising to me. I don't know. Those IMDb ratings are so weird because, like, if you look at TV episodes, they're always, like, really high. And then you look at movies, and I guess it's because the people watching the list are probably X-Files, you know, whereas people watching, you know, X-Files, I want to believe, are a mix of fans and non-fans. So that's why. Also, well, that movie's kind of garbage, but yeah.
So. I mean, I don't think I'd put this quite so low down the list of the season. I mean, I'd probably put it a few notches higher. I don't know. It's not one of my favorites by any means, but 22nd out of 24 is quite low. Yeah, so we'll get into the scene by scene, I guess. So yeah, after this next jingle, we'll have our in-depth look at the list. All right, so we pick up with a nice moody scene, don't we? We're on a road at night. It's like shrouded in mist. We see this guy get in a car. We later find out he's an executioner, don't we? And then we're at the East Point State Penitentiary in Florida. We meet the warden. We'll come back to him in a bit because he's an interesting guy, an interesting actor. But then we see this character, Neech Manley, in the cell. He's about to be led off to his death, isn't he? He's with his wife. At one point, she says to him, you know, I ain't ever going to love another man. And that turns out to be quite pivotal later on. So, you know, he's led to the to the electric chair. You know, I thought there were some effective, like, POV shots there as he kind of approaches the chair, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And just the whole way that the episode starts, like, with them picking up the executioner on the side of the road and everything. Like, I kind of like that. It's almost, I wouldn't say like misdirection, but it's like the way that you get into this story, which, you know, the X-Files does a lot, where it's like, you know, here's a story. Like, it's like told from the perspective of the executioner. Like, you think that he's going to be the main character, and then mm-hmm. that basically takes you into the prison where you kind of like see this other story, and this dude who we start off with is basically just a minor component in the overall story. But I like that kind of, you know, start small and use that as like a gateway to get into something larger. You know, that sort of storytelling is cool.
Yeah, and that executioner, he comes back a bit later, doesn't he? But he's by no means like pivotal to the episode, really. And so Nietzsche is kind of strapped into the chair. He declines the hood that's offered him. He starts to talk a bit about like the Lord and Allah, and his kind of knowledge of religions plays into the episode a bit later, doesn't it? So one of the things he says is, "I will return to avenge all the petty tyranny and cruelty I have suffered, and 5 men will die." And then obviously the teaser ends with like the switch is flipped and he's executed. So overall, what did you make of this sequence as kind of a way into the episode, you know, ending with his demise, obviously?
I thought it was pretty good. Yeah, it hooked me.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the actor playing Nietzsche, I think his name is, I'm probably going to mangle the pronunciation of this, but it's like Badjar Jola. And he's got an interesting role, hasn't he? Because he's got like a very limited time to make a real impression. But then his kind of presence has got to kind of almost like haunt the episode like thereafter, doesn't it? So, yeah. I mean, I felt he was like very imposing. So I felt he did a pretty good job, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. And then we pick up after the teaser in the X-Files office. I mean, it's always good to see a Mulder slideshow, I think. And So I think essentially what he says is that a guard has died in the prison since Nietzsche's execution, and you know his death is unexplained. So it's always fascinating to figure out kind of how they're going to get Mulder and Scully on the case here. But you know, as far as it goes, it seemed to sort of do the job well enough, I thought.
Yeah, it's interesting because like usually the way these things play out is you see whatever it is that gets them into the case in the teaser, and then it's Mulder sort of recapping what we just saw. But in this case, I mean, the first part is true. You know, what occurs in the teaser is what gets them into the case, but that's not the thing which sort of like sets off the X-Files alarm. You know, it's that someone else died. You know, it's the next thing that happens. So that's kind of a cool little twist on things.
Next, they're kind of at the prison.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And they have a bit of a walk and talk with the warden. And the warden's played by a guy called J.T. Walsh. And he's an interesting like character actor. I don't know if you are familiar with much of his other work, Mike?
Yeah, he's awesome. Every time you know he shows up in a movie, it's just like, oh, that guy's so cool. And I mean, the thing which I guess because this is sort of like the first thing that I ever saw him in, but the thing that I sort of know him from more than anything is one of the very first and best X-Files ripoffs in television, Dark Skies, which he shot just a year after this, which is a great show. When are you guys going to start doing the Dark Cast or whatever you want to call it? Be sure to sign me up for that one because I love that show.
I've never seen that series, you know. It's just completely passed me by. But yeah, I'll once we've done with, you know, we've got 150 more episodes to go. We're going at like a glacial pace. But yeah,
I'll mark my calendar. But Yeah, check out Dark Skies. I mean, seriously, like, because I'm guessing now that's a show which probably just complete, like, no one, you know, it's been lost to time or whatever. But yeah, it came out in 96, so it would have been like season four of The X-Files. And it was basically like, it took place in like the 60s, and there was this whole conspiracy about aliens and the government and everything. And the sort of like twist on the format that they did was it would take you through history, and you'd see all these like historical events and how they were affected by aliens. But
yeah,
J.T. Walsh was basically like the cigarette smoking man of that show. So
yeah, well, I can believe that because he's got a really like strong presence, I think. And what's interesting is he only it's about 3 or 4 years after this episode is made that he dies. Sadly.
Yeah.
I mean, I know him mainly from his film roles, and I'm not sure what would be classed as like his most notable role, but he pops up in stuff like A Few Good Men and Sling Blade and all sorts of other movies. So he had an interesting career. Anyway, he's one of those guys that, you know he's going to bring something to the table when he pops up. And the same here, I think. He, you know, made the most of the role he was given here, I felt.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's really good.
And one of the things about this walk and talk through the prison is, you know, you get this sense of, you know, Scully looking at the inmates and the inmates looking back at her. And, like, I take your point about what you said at the outset about, like, the episode wasn't really trying to say much. But what I liked about this was that it wasn't too labored. You know, it wasn't like Carter was trying to, with some of his episodes, he can get very heavy-handed with his messages. But there's a little bit of kind of delicacy here, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. And you do really kind of get that sort of like Silence of the Lambs vibe, you know, here too. In addition to the you know, Nietzsche, the character of Nietzsche is very sort of Hannibal Lecter-ish, where they're like, oh, the dude was a genius, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And he learns to reincarnate by reading is the suggestion as well. And anyway, the warden suggests that there's some kind of a, like, elaborate conspiracy that's being like played out. That's how he's approaching things. You know, Scully has a look at the first body, which, like, I think she sort of takes the cover off, and it's covered with maggots, isn't it? So that was kind of icky, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's gross.
They meet an inmate called Speranza. Mulder interviews him, and, you know, he's saying, like, Nietzsche's back, and Mulder's like, you know, in what form? And Speranza's like, he didn't specify. So, I mean, I was wondering about this. Is, like, the lack of rules that they set up here kind of a problem? Because it seems to me kind of, like, indeterminate exactly what Nietzsche can and can't do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I guess I don't really have a problem with that so much, because so much of The X-Files is like, I mean, what episode doesn't end with a sort of like, oh, I guess we'll never know for sure, you know, that kind of thing. There's so much left up to, you know, just sort of like ambiguity that, you know, saying, you know, like, oh, this is the thing, but we're not going to tell you how it works. I'm okay with that. You know, especially in this context, like, I don't need to know the mechanics of it. It's fine.
Yeah, I think it tends to be more of it's something that comes up a lot in like ghost stories, I think, where, you know, the ghosts can kind of do exactly what the plot requires, you know, from scene to scene.
Yeah, that can certainly be a problem for sure. I mean, magic is another one, you know, where it's like, what are you doing? But I mean, I think in this context, it's fine. Yeah.
So Scully kind of wanders off, doesn't she? She wants to have a look at the cell the guard was murdered in. And, you know, there's some nice stuff here. Like, she walks down the hall and everything. I mean, as we've already said, this set, you know, it was a great set, it looked like to me anyway, and they seemed to get the most out of it. The photography was really atmospheric, wasn't it, in these scenes? And, like, the colour palette, you know, has got this kind of greenish tint to everything. So aesthetically, I thought there was a lot to enjoy here, you know?
Yeah, it looked really good.
And she talks to the guard. His name is Fournier, I think. And he's like, you know, it's not happening. Nietzsche isn't back. I mean, he gets called away, and Scully kind of decides to explore the prison a bit further, which seemed a bit questionable to me. And she gets kind of accosted from behind. And I think this episode worked best when it kind of gestures towards being like a flat-out horror, you know, because that's kind of a scary moment. And there are a couple of others too. I sort of wish it had gone a bit further in that direction, really.
Yeah. I mean, X-Files does that well, especially, you know, given their limitations. And this is, I think, a good example of that for sure.
Yeah, and the guy who's kind of accosted her, he's called Parmelli. He's pretty, like, significant here, isn't he? He's played by a guy called Ken Foray.
Yeah, well, his big, most famous role is Dawn of the Dead, where he plays one of the guys who's sort of, like, holed up in the mall. So he's very much sort of a cult actor, you know, very popular in the genre, but, you know, not exactly someone who you see in anything mainstream. But yeah, he's really good, for sure.
Yeah, he was good. And he sort of says, you know, there's a list and there's somebody called Roke on the list, you know, and by that point, Scully's kind of unsettled, isn't she? She's ready to go. Again, I like the fact they don't make too much of a big deal out of it, I think. And then the next day, you know, the prisoners are coming in to do some work, I think, and they find a head in a paint tin. So, you know, another pretty striking scene. I mean, I don't know exactly how the head got in there or anything. But...
yeah, but it was certainly creepy. And I like how, you know, I mean, whenever you see these movies which take place in prison or whatever, you know, it really sort of like presents the inmates as, you know, these very sort of like tough individuals. And, you know, when they see that head in that can, they're all freaking out, as you would. Mm-hmm. But I like that because it really does show how terrifying this is, you know. When you see the tough guys scared of this thing, then you know that it's really scary. So
yeah, totally. I think next we're kind of at the morgue and Scully's kind of chatting with a medical examiner about the head and everything. And this is while Mulder's going to see this guy Roke about the list. Mm-hmm. You know, he's saying, you know, I know who's on the list. I want a deal. I want to transfer out of here. That kind of thing. Which I think they run it past the warden, don't they? And he's like, we won't make a deal. And there's some interesting stuff here where the warden talks a little bit about like the dynamic between the prisoners and the inmates. He compares it to like a war situation, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I thought that was interesting, but I mean, what do you think? Do you think they should have sort of played that up a bit further or what?
Well, I mean, I think setting it up here makes sense because it sort of like establishes the dynamics and of the sort of like politics of the situation, you know, why they can't negotiate with the inmates and how that, you know, would set them up as targets in the future and everything. And all of that makes sense, but it really does put you between a rock and a hard place because right now, you know, guards are getting killed and you need to sort of stop that. But how do you stop it?
Yeah,
it's tricky.
It is. And then so the warden like enters his office, doesn't he? And that's the point at which they find like the body, like minus head, of the guard from a few minutes earlier, Fournier. Yeah. And then there's an interesting scene next, which is when they go and check out Nietzsche's cell. So, you know, this is where Mulder and Scully are looking at his books and they're talking about reincarnation and like how every religion encompasses the idea of life after death. Obviously, it's not too long since we've seen, like, the 11th season, I guess, and arguably, at times, they struggle to set up, like, an opposition between Mulder and Scully there, but this is, like, a decent example, I think, of, like, the classical way they would sort of set up Mulder and Scully with two opposing viewpoints, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be, you know, the fairly well-established dynamic, and it works well, of course.
Yeah, and there's not much humor in this episode, is there, but there's a couple of moments, and one of them comes here where it's like, you know, Mulder says, like, imagine you could come back and take out five people. And Scully's like, well, I only get five? And Mulder's like, I remembered your birthday this year, didn't I, Scully? So, I don't know, there's not much to, like, chuckle at this episode, isn't there? But there's that moment. I think there's one coming up later as well, isn't there? So, maybe it could have done with a bit more, to be honest.
Probably, yeah. I mean, it's a tough balancing act, because obviously this is some pretty dark material, but... usually the X-Files is pretty good at balancing the humor with the drama.
Yeah. What do you think about this, like, this whole thing about he's read every book about reincarnation that ever exists or whatever? Because, I mean, they never confirm this, but Mulder, I think, sort of gets the idea that, you know, he's developed the ability to reincarnate after becoming such an expert. I don't know. It seemed a bit thin to me, is what I would say, I guess.
Yeah, it's a little thin, but I guess if you read just that one book, which happens to hold the key, and, you know, you try it out and it works. I mean, it's certainly not the biggest stretch we've seen on the X-Files. It's more explanation than we get in a lot of episodes, for sure. I mean, I'm not excusing it. I'm not saying that it's a great, you know, like, this is airtight, you know, or anything like that. But the X-Files is kind of known for glossing over these details in a lot of ways.
the upshot anyway, this scene is like they decide to go and visit Nietzsche's wife. And so then we see them at her house. Her name is Danielle, played by an actress called April Grace. And, you know, she comes off immediately, doesn't she, as like incredibly like nervy. Yeah, I don't know if it was a bit too much, but she was kind of shaking all over the place, wasn't she?
Yeah, you know, April Grace. I mean, this is kind of like an all-star cast this week. April Grace has been in a number of things. Most notably, I think, would be Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson, where she plays the TV interviewer who's interviewing Tom Cruise's character.
Yeah, that's right.
She's awesome in that movie. But, yeah. It's kind of cool to see. I guess Chris Carter's like, whatever, you know, I'm directing. I'm going to bring in all the big guns this week. So,
cool. Yeah, it's a well-cast episode, I think. And what she's sort of saying is she's talking about her dreams of, like, Nietzsche being unkillable and I could feel the power of his beliefs and so on. She thinks he may have come back. And I guess it's like I said, that because the actor who played Nietzsche kind of makes a decent impression in his, like, one scene, his one proper scene, it sort of gives a bit of, lends a bit of credence to this kind of thing when they're talking about him, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I hadn't thought about that until you said.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
But it really does kind of like show the importance of that role, even though you basically only see him in that one scene.
Yeah, and then I think we're back at the prison. The Roke is taken to the showers, isn't he, to the warden, I think, who kind of assaults him. And he's trying to figure out, like, who's on the list? Am I on the list? And Roke tells him, like, you're number 5. And there's a good line there. It's like, how does it feel to be on death row? So I liked the idea that the balance of power has shifted, you know. I mean, is this a problem? I mean, there are no really likable characters in this episode, are there? I don't think. I mean, outside of Mulder and Scully, who are kind of peripheral. I didn't really care a great deal about anybody else, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the nature of the story, but it still is interesting to sort of like see the dynamics at play on an objective level. And, you know, I mean, just kind of like looking at the timeline, like this stuff, like with the, you know, where the warden is kind of, you know, bullying the inmates, it really sort of gave me, I mean, I guess it's kind of a cliche of the prison movie genre or whatever, but it really sort of gave me a Shawshank Redemption kind of vibe. And, you know, looking at the timeline, I guess this was released like less than a year after Shawshank Redemption came out. So I would imagine that was kind of swirling around in Carter's head when he was writing this thing.
I would guess so. And like what's interesting, it sort of precedes The Green Mile as well. A couple of years, I think, which it kind of recalls also.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And there's kind of like a racial subtext here, isn't there? I don't think it's ever acknowledged in dialogue, but I think it's like all the named prisoners are black, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess they are. Yeah.
Yeah, and the guards and the warden is are white, obviously, and they're kind of like abusing their power.
Aside from Ken Forey, who...
aside from him, yeah. So, yeah, interesting that Carter didn't choose to, like, signpost that any more than he did.
Yeah.
So the agents are called back to the prison. Like, Roke is actually dead, isn't he? He was beaten to death is what happened. And I think when the agents leave, this is when we see that, like, Parmelee and Nietzsche's wife are actually together, aren't they? So he's kind of trying to reassure her everything's going to be all right, so on and so forth. The plot moves pretty swiftly on then, doesn't it? Kind of Mulder to the warden and sort of saying, you know, I sort of lost the thread of what he was saying, but the upshot of it was kind of like Roke might not have been on the list. You know, he doesn't trust that was part of the original plan. And he wants the name of the executioner. And then this scene with the executioner I liked. It's like at the house, you know, they pick up the mail. There's a couple of days worth of mail there. And they have a good look around, don't they? And I thought this was like well staged, well shot. You know, Scully sort of notices the maggots on the carpet. Sort of looks up to the ceiling and they're sort of falling out from the light fixture. And that's before they discover the body in the chair. And I thought this was a good little scene.
Yeah, you know, the stuff with the executioner, I think, is really interesting. I mean, to me, it's almost the most interesting part in the movie because, or the show, because it kind of like tells the tale of who these executioners are, in a sense, which are like literally like just people who answer want ads in the paper or whatever. And, you know, like seeing him in that first scene where they're picking him up on the side of the road. And then that, I mean, I found it to be like a really striking image where he's got the hood on when he's actually like performing the execution, because like the hood is so like ominous and almost theatrical, but like the rest of his costume is literally just like a polo shirt and some khakis or whatever. And it's like, this is just a normal guy who is doing this probably because they really need the money. You know, I mean, why else would, well, I guess because you're kind of sick, but I was going to say, why else would someone do this? You know, I guess if you get a thrill out of killing people, you know, but that's not how it's presented here. It's really presented as sort of like a job for people who are desperate for work, you know? And I don't know. I mean, just that whole presentation of that thing, which, you know, as we were saying at the beginning, not at all really important to the overall story, but like everything that it says there, I think is, I mean, that to me is like the most interesting part of the episode. And I think it's, it's really well done.
It is. And it's kind of, I don't know if it's harsh exactly, but the fact that the executioner ends up on the list.
Yeah.
When, you know, he was kind of just carrying out his duty. And I'm not saying like, you know, I'm not saying capital punishment's good or anything, but he wasn't directly, you know, involved in Nietzsche's life until the very end. So that was interesting, though, that Nietzsche had this very like black and white kind of approach to like who deserves, you know, to be, you know, to be taken out and who doesn't.
Yeah.
So, and then we're back at the prison. Speranza again, being talked to by Mulder, who wants the remaining names on the list. You know, he sort of says that I've seen Nietzsche. Roke wasn't on the list, and Scully enters, and she's found some kind of link with like a lawyer who may be involved in all of this. So quite deep into the episode, and we're still kind of being introduced to like new characters left, right, and center, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what did you think of this guy then, the lawyer? His name was Danny Charez, I think.
You know, it's a little cliche, you know. Yeah. I mean, kind of something that you see in a million TV shows and movies all the time, but whatever. It served its purpose in terms of the plot. Yeah,
I suppose it did. And like what's said is that he was Nietzsche's lawyer at one point. Wasn't really cut out for the job, I think, is the suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks he might be on the list for that reason. He passes on a bit of information, doesn't he? That's kind of what he exists for, I guess, is to tell Mulder and Scully about Nietzsche's wife having a boyfriend who works at the prison.
Yeah.
And eventually, of course, he gets suffocated with a pillow, doesn't he? Although we sort of see the assailant's face, but only like very briefly. So, I mean, I couldn't work out if it was supposed to be. I think it's supposed to be Nietzsche, isn't it? But I think they're trying to set up a bit of ambiguity about whether it's him or Parnelli is how I took it, I think.
Yeah, and that scene, it definitely looks like it's part. Is it Parnelli or Parmelli? I forget. But
I think it's Parnelli with
Parnelli?
An N.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely looks like it's Parnelli, you know, but obviously. Well, I don't know. Could it be? Now that I'm trying to track it, like, could it have been Parnelli and this guy wasn't on the list, or is it? I lose count. I'm sorry. It's like replicants in Blade Runner. It's like, who? What's going on?
Yeah, how many are there? Well, no, it could be. I couldn't work it out because the very next scene is like Parnelli's been out and he's driving back to Danielle's house, isn't it? So it could have been that he, you know, had just come from killing the lawyer. I don't know. It's about this part in the episode where the plot really starts to kind of. The convolutions start to pile up a little bit.
There's so many twists and turns and misdirections and everything, and people getting killed who are on the list but aren't on the list, and we didn't see this dude get killed. It gets a little confusing. It's hard to track.
What's good, I think, about here, though, is that, you know, we get another nice little moment for the characters where it's like Mulder and Scully are on the kind of, they're watching the house, aren't they? So yeah. Scully says, a woman gets lonely. Sometimes she can't wait around for a man to be reincarnated. So, I mean, it's a pretty good line, and I'll take it in this episode. So you got to take what you can get, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
So when they see he turns up, Parnelli, then they take that as their cue to get back to the prison and sort of kind of inform on him to the warden, really, sadly. And
yeah.
So they notify the warden, And it turns out he only transferred to the prison recently. So this is where the warden tells them about the lawyer's death, and they think that could be the fifth victim now. What sort of sets up this final like climax to the episode is that, you know, Mulder and Scully are off to arrest Parnelli, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, what did you think about their role in this episode? Because, I mean, like I said, they're kind of peripheral. It happened a lot in the old days. I mean, when the series came back for seasons 10 and 11, and Mulder and Scully were back on the X-Files and everything, this didn't happen as much anymore. There were only really one or two episodes in the revival where they were in the background of a case, you know, and it wasn't sort of the characters that were driving it. I think it works very well in the early days of the series. It sort of looks a bit kind of outmoded now, perhaps, when you consider modern TV, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it is part of sort of that almost like anthology style that they have in the show. And I like the fact that they can do it here. You know, it's not something which they need to do. It's not like it's a weekly thing necessarily, but it's something which they can do if that is best for the story that they're telling. And I mean, it kind of like speaks to that thing about the X-Files, that thing that makes it so cool, which is like, it's so malleable. It can literally be like whatever it needs to be. It can tell any story it wants to tell, because in a sense there are no rules, you know, this is sort of like a weird little subset of that. And I think that it can work really well. I'm not sure how well it works in this particular instance, but I like the idea that like, if Chris Carter's like, well, I want to set a show in a prison and, you know, all these things happen and whatever. I know that, you know, my show is about, you know, these two FBI agents, but they can just sort of be the eyes and ears of the audience and don't really need to get involved in the plot that much and whatever. It's all good, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what normally happens is it's their job to kind of work out the plot for us. I mean, yeah. And we'll come on to this in a bit, but like at the end of the episode, they're still kind of clueless, which is kind of unusual.
Yeah.
But before that point, they go to the house, don't they? And I did like some aspects of this final scene quite a bit. You know, there's a great like POV camera shot that kind of prowls around the house before we see Danielle, who she sees Neach, and his face is kind of like half in shadow, which I thought was very effective too.
Mm-hmm.
Then afterwards, I don't know, I'm not quite as sure, because she kind of leaves the room, finds Parnelli at the window. She seems to think he is Neach in some kind of way. She points a gun at him. Mulder and Scully turn up, but they're kind of too late, really, aren't they? Because Parnelli's trying to calm her down, but she ends up like kind of shooting him dead. So I don't know. Did you think this sequence was pretty effective, or what?
I thought it was okay. I mean, it didn't blow me away by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I think that it's I guess in some ways it's one last misdirect, because we think that somehow Neach has reincarnated through Parnelli, but that's not the case. So. Yeah,
and it's not quite over, is it? We've still got a couple of scenes, and one of them is like Speranza. I mean, when I said there were no likable characters, this guy Speranza seemed okay, actually. Although he, he must have done something bad to get where he is. But
yeah,
he's kind of led to the warden again. The showers, you know, we sort of, kind of realize this is where you get taken when bad stuff's going to go down. But before that, there was a great shot where the camera's like positioned at ground level, kind of looking down the corridor at him. And he sort of says, like, there's one man left on the list. And the warden really starts to lay into him, doesn't he, as the camera sort of, like, starts to back away. And I thought that was, like, very good.
Yeah, for sure.
And then, we're heading into the end of the episode there. So we're back with Mulder and Scully. I mean, what I did like about this scene, it starts off, you know, you can tell Mulder's bothered. He sort of pulls over. He seems to need a bit of air. So I really liked his kind of demeanor in this scene, because it's kind of unusual for the series. But I suppose when he starts talking about it, just doesn't make sense. I mean, I sort of know exactly how he felt, really. And I don't know, what did you make of it? Because like, it sort of seems like the plot sounds kind of ludicrous and convoluted when they start to try and hash it out, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what they're trying to set up here is, you know, like, since there are missing pieces and whatever, and maybe this isn't, maybe we didn't get this one right, you know, maybe... You know, the wife didn't get this one right, and that of course leads to the final scene where you see like, oh, look at that, you know. And so yeah, it's a, I don't know. It's a very X-Files type of scene, I guess. You know, this whole episode feels like very, you know, sort of like by the numbers X-Files.
I think if I felt that the answers to the plot issues were solvable, I guess I would feel a bit more charitable towards it. But hey, it is what it is, I suppose. And like we said, that final scene with the car crash and Neach appearing behind the warden and everything and grabbing him and steering him off the road, that's all like really well done, isn't it? And I used the word visceral already, didn't I? But a very kind of hard-hitting impact with the tree.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that car is like destroyed, and it certainly looks like they just took a car and crashed it head on into that tree. And yeah, it's crazy. Really well done.
Yeah, really well done. And that's it for the list. But in a moment, we're going to look through some listener feedback about this episode. Okay, so let's have a look at the mailbag. And these are people who got back in touch with us about this episode on Facebook. And Andrew Blake has said he thinks this is a pretty underrated episode. Set design is excellent, and the episode maintains a gothic, creepy tone throughout. Solid script and writing by Chris Carter. Adam Silver says, not one of Carter's most discussed episodes, but he received the Directors Guild of America nomination for it. The prison set is realised quite well, so probably more remembered for the visuals, but prison abuse and executions are interesting subjects to touch on. I also believe Carter wanted there to be a case that Mulder and Scully didn't solve. So I didn't realise there'd been some awards kind of buzz about this episode with Carter's nomination. But, I mean, I don't know who he was up against or anything, but I can see that. You know, it was a very striking episode, wasn't it, visually?
Yeah, but now I'm really curious to see if, like, any of the other episodes from that season got nominated. Because, I mean, season 3 has some pretty heavy hitters in it. I mean, was Rob Bowman nominated for Jose Chung's From Outer Space? I mean, if not, then what? You know?
Why not? Yeah. Well, I know the episode, do you remember Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose?
Yeah.
I know that got some like Emmy attention. I know Darren Morgan won an Emmy for writing that one, for example.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it's not like they were pinning all their hopes on the list, thankfully. Tony Black says, I genuinely think the list is a great episode. Very, very underrated. Always has been. Shot with incredible atmosphere, brilliant use of lighting on the prison set. The plot is a bit randomly convoluted, but I love how it ends with Mulder, for once, genuinely rattled that it didn't all add up. Plus, this has the late, great J.T. Walsh as one of the nastiest villains the show ever gave us. Cracking episode. Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what Tony says there. You know, it is shot with incredible atmosphere. The lighting is brilliant. The plot is, like, more than a bit randomly convoluted, I would say. But for whatever reason, it just doesn't grab me as much as it does him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And J.T. Walsh is a nasty villain. It's definitely true. Yeah, I don't know. I guess underrated. I mean, I can see the case of like people saying this is underrated because it's one of those kind of under the radar episodes, but it doesn't get discussed a lot. There aren't any massively significant Mulder Scully moments here, really. So underrated. I can see the case for it, I suppose.
Maybe. I think it's appropriately rated.
You think it's appropriately forgotten about? Yeah. All right. Well. Two messages here that we'll do in a row. Kieran McCarthy, first of all, and then Paige Schechter. And what I thought was interesting here is they kind of disagreed on an aspect of the episode. So Kieran said, I really enjoyed this episode on my latest rewatch. The set design and lighting look stunning on Blu-ray. And yeah, that's how I watched it on Blu-ray. It does look really good. And he says, I believe it was one of the more expensive season 3 episodes due to the massive prison set. I'd consider it one of Carter's better episodes and agreed it is very underrated. The fact that it's light on Carter's usual purple prose is also a nice bonus. And Paige said, I like it very much. You can tell it's a Chris Carter joint because the dialogue can be overbaked, but it doesn't take away from one of the true suspenseful episodes. It's difficult to guess who the next victims are and when the list is actually complete. There were so many people who wronged Neach, 5 is a low number. Scully doesn't usually get the best lines, but the quip about a woman not being able to wait around until a man gets reincarnated is choice. So what I thought was interesting there is that, you know, Kieran talks about it's light on Carter's usual purple prose, and then Paige refers to the dialogue being a bit overbaked. I didn't really notice anything that jumped out at me that was kind of jarring as regards the dialogue. It all seemed solid enough to me. I don't know if you picked up on any examples.
Yeah, I didn't really see it as being noteworthy in that regard either way, to be honest.
Yeah, it's kind of functional, yeah. I guess. Final message for the mailbag for today from Anna Bastow, who said, "This was an episode I didn't care much about the first time, but I grew to love it. Dark, moody, with a very complex theme and a very interesting set of characters. In the show, it is one of the first official episodes where we see Carter's theology. The secret to all the powers in the world and immortality was learning all religions and holy books. Just like all the holy books are written in the surface of the biogenesis ships. The man sticks to his motives for better and worse." And I hadn't really thought of it in that sense, but I think that's an interesting observation. And then even all the way up to like season 10, when you get the infamous episode Babylon, there's stuff in there about like the power of words and stuff. So maybe this is an example of Carter kind of scoping out one of his, you know, one of his more esoteric interests or something. It works pretty well here. Like we said, it's not watertight in terms of plotting, but it's serviceable, I suppose, all the stuff about learning the religions.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, there's definitely, the entire show definitely plays with that idea of religion and the power of religion and, you know, that's just the whole, like, Mulder-Scully dynamic, of course. So it's obviously a subject which interests him a lot. And seeing his own personal ideas manifest themselves in different ways, even though they're the same ideas, is a pretty interesting thing.
Yeah, and I think his interest in that would kind of deepen as the years went on. Mm-hmm. As well. I mean, I guess some final thoughts on this episode. I mean, I really do like the kind of built-in suspense of like the five names on the list, I think is a very good concept. I think maybe the problem is that you don't really have the time here to set people up, or, you know, if there is a time, they don't manage to do it, I don't think, to get you to the point where you care about any of these people. I think maybe like a two-hour film would have had a better shot at it. Having said that, you know, interesting stuff here, well shot, in a very, very good season. This is not anywhere near the top of the list for me. But yeah, I don't dislike it by any means.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty solid episode, you know, all things considered. I maybe I'm harsh on it because I expect more out of the X-Files, you know. I mean, I don't know. It's definitely not a noteworthy episode. It's definitely one which I would ever in a million years just put on just to watch. The only time I'm ever going to see this is if I'm, you know, doing like a series rewatch, or if I'm going to show up on a podcast about it. But yeah. But it's not terrible by any stretch of the imagination. I just don't really see anything in it which is sort of like worthy of the time investment either. So there's a ton more episodes of the X-Files which have a lot more to offer than this one.
It's interesting that the feedback we had was much more positive than we were, but I'm going to assume that there are like many more people who saw the call for feedback and decided not to bother, you know.
I would imagine there are a lot of people who saw the call for feedback and were like, which episode's that one? Because that's what I was like.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Quite possibly. All right, so I guess we'll wrap up there. So, cheers, Mike. Nice to talk to you. And, I mean, yeah, tell us about your podcasting adventures. Give us a bit of a plug if you want.
Yeah, well, I just started up a new show that I'm really kind of excited about called Film Damage. Me and my friend Max, we were projectionists together at a movie theater for like 10 years. And our new show is basically, we look at movies, but from the perspective of the booth. So like we'll open each episode with like some little tale about film projection or whatever, and then just sort of go from there. And it's a lot of fun. It's not like super, super technical or anything, but if you want sort of a day in the life of a projectionist thing, head on over to filmdamagepod.com and you can find it there, or, you know, on iTunes and all that good stuff.
Cheers, Mike. And in the meantime, listeners, you find us in all the usual places. So if you want to support the podcast, you go to patreon.com/thexcast to have a look. On Twitter, we're at @thex_cast. On Facebook, search for Xcast and you should find X-Files Basement, the Xcast podcast fan group. And one last thing, I mean, if you go to iTunes and find us there and just take a few seconds to rate and review us, that would be much appreciated by all of us. But until next time, listeners, always remember, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at IAmWillAye.